for that game. Cameron Wolf in the second hour, you just made the list. We'll talk a little hockey with Kevin Allen later on, pick six. Got a really good show in store for you. Preds win 4-1. Good homestand for them. Two games, 4 points. Samuel Girard, the young man we've been talking about, the 19-year-old, making his second NHL start, gets a goal and an assist. His goal tied it up early on in the second period. His assist was the game-winning assist because Philip Forsberg had the game-winning goal. So it was his shot on the power play, and Forsberg with the rebound in front. And Willie, the rest is history. They got a couple more. They tacked on a couple more in the third period. An empty netter by P.K. Subban and Victor Arvidsson basically broke their backs with about 5 minutes to go to extend the lead. But a good win over the Stars.
Fun night.
It was.
I mean, it was it really got going. The first period, there wasn't much energy going in the building. It was, and they got behind, and you're like, what's going on? Is this... This isn't the Smashville I know. And then all of a sudden, when Sam Girard scored that goal,
he gave the building
place
life.
Absolutely came alive.
It's alive.
And for the rest of the night,
it was alive.
Yep. It was a big, big night. It was a nice story. Sam Girard was a nice story in training camp. It got very intriguing on Tuesday, but it was the story last night.
And probably
and now around the league, people are going to have to say, "Wow, we got to take note of this guy."
I think they already are doing that. I had a talk with him second period intermission, and it was just cool because he came up for post game during preseason, but to talk to him about his first NHL goal, I mean, that's cool and the significance of it, and to have his family here. He did tell me, Willie, that he had more family here on Tuesday night. Some of them had to leave, so he didn't have as much here as he had for Tuesday night for his NHL debut. But you can imagine the ones who had to leave. Oh, man, really?
Well, there were some priceless.
And by the way.
Priceless shots in the crowd.
They were high
just
fives.
Awesome.
It was great.
The emotion. The mom was crying. Has been crying for 3 days. I mean, just every time you see her, she is so overwhelmed.
She's a mess.
It's awesome.
Yep, I know.
It's awesome.
We brought this up. In fact, Hal Gill brought this up in postgame when we were talking about him. It was a really good point because we've talked so much about him lately, but it's really been more about his skating ability, his hockey IQ, you know, his elusiveness, all the other things that he possesses. 19 years old, NHL debut, smaller guy, all these other traits. You know what we weren't talking about? His shot. You know, by the way, that was a heck of a shot last night from the point. A blast top shelf on Bishop. He's got a rocket for a shot, and he fired away on the Forsberg goal. That's how he got it. It was blasted it off. What did it hit? Bishop's chest? I don't remember what it hit. I don't know if it hit his glove. I don't know, but Forsberg was there to collect it on the other side. But he's got a good shot too.
He's got a heck of a shot. That was a weapon we did not see on Tuesday. And to be honest, we were talking to the coaching staff, and they thought maybe he was a little too indecisive on Tuesday. He did the dynamic skating, and one of the things that they emphasized with him was go ahead and make your play. Make a decisive play. You can do it. You have the tools. And so I think maybe that was the little buzzword that allowed him to pull the trigger. Sometimes I think when you're so young, you're almost deferring to the older players. Sometimes, and you pass up a shot because you want to be unselfish. You want to do the right thing. But I think it was time for him to just show everybody he can shoot.
You know who's really good at that, and you know the answer to this? Is Peter Laviolette.
Yeah.
We've talked about this much where he has these talks with these players, and he has the ability to put them at ease and say, look, this is what we want you to do. Don't worry about it, okay? Don't overthink it. Don't think about it. You're not coming out. It won't be your last shift. Go do your thing. He has had this talk before with other players, and you know what? He's had a pretty good success rate because it works. Once they stop, you know, worrying about looking over their shoulder if I make a mistake, because that happens not only in hockey but in sports.
Yes.
When players are looking over their shoulder or they're scared to do something because they're afraid it's going to cost them playing time, it's hard to be effective when you're nervous to and you're not being yourself. Well, he's very good about pulling players aside and saying, look, we know what skill set you possess. This is what we want you to do, and don't worry about it. If you make a mistake, you make a mistake. We can live with that. But be this guy. We need you to be this guy, and that's what they do.
If I'd have told you going into the game Tuesday and Thursday, Roman Josi is going to miss both games. They'll be without, obviously, Ryan Ellis. Can they sweep these two games? I'd have been a little skeptical, but Gerard gave him a lift. These are big games. You know, you're trying to get to a point where Ellis comes back. He's such an important player, Ellis, in so many ways. But you can see the team adapting. That's a real positive sign. And I think what you're saying is a big part of it. The role players. It was a big reason why they were able to get by without Johansson and Fisher for those two games against Anaheim and then on into the Stanley Cup Finals, because they have that mentality. Go out there and make something positive happen. Don't go out there worried about making a mistake or just trying to prevent something bad from happening. And so that's Gerard is a great example, because he can do a lot of things out there. And it would be easy for a coach to say, hey, wait a minute, we got to rein this guy in. This guy's nuts. People were on Twitter trying to come up with names for some of these spin moves he's making and things like that. It's really something. And now, with each passing game, I would imagine he's going to be in there again Saturday, one way or the other.
How do you take him out of the lineup?
Well, they almost don't have a choice, because they've lost another defenseman.
Unless they don't
want
to play him on the road. Well, yeah, you're right. That's a good point. I mean, we don't know the status on him. Something we talked about last night is Martin Hanza going to get suspended?
I think that's a suspendable.
Should, right?
I thought he should have been thrown out of the game.
But that's what they're trying to get out of the game. That
yes.
is textbook. So, one, why didn't he have to leave the game? I mean, yes, he got a five-minute major, but why wasn't he sent packing for the night? And two, if the league doesn't suspend him, I don't know what else is a suspendable offense, because that's the exact play they're trying to take out of the game.
I think so.
Hits to the head.
The league, when we were up in the league meetings and they try to educate the broadcasters on what they're trying to do with these things, they showed a lot of statistics and they showed a lot of video. And one thing that they're pretty proud of is that they have, over the last 5 years or so, decreased the number of suspensions. And the message is they feel like they have educated the players well. But that hit honestly did look like something we saw 7 to 10 years ago, which used to be a legal play. But I think that's got to be looked at very, very closely, and I think that's a suspendable play. It's unnecessary. It's just back in the day, that was part of the game. But I think the players themselves have decided, with all of the issues that are out there, that's the kind of hit we don't need.
Concussion.
It's unnecessary. You can play this game and still be physical, mm-hmm. still be fast without a hit like that.
Yep.
And I realize Hansel's tall.
Does I mean you got to you got to know
he's extending his.
He knew what he was doing.
He's extending his forearm. He made contact with the head. No.
That's what I brought up to Hal last night. I'm like, okay, you understand. Hansel's a huge guy. But if you know the rules and you know what you can and can't do, it doesn't matter if you're 6'6" or if you're 5'6", you have to know what you can and can't do. And he knows he can't do that. Then you have to adjust. You say, well, he's bigger, so it's a little bit easier to hit high. Well, then you have to do things differently, because you're just – that's not acceptable. So I do think something's coming his way. I don't know what – like games-wise, but something's coming his way. I can't imagine they're going to let it be at just a five-minute major and call it a day. I would be surprised by that.
I hope so.
I've got, let's see, right, strike three.
Okay, we're watching NHL Network. There's the hit right there.
It just ended. Bryce Harper just struck out, so the Cubs, it's official. They just beat the Nationals. Game just ended. Good game, yeah.
Okay, here's a quiz question.
What was the official time? 17 hours, 36 minutes?
It might have been. Let's just put it this way. I knew the game was going to take a while, but I did not think I would be able to be home, sitting on my couch after the broadcast, and be able to watch the last three innings.
Well, I did not get to watch three innings.
I saw two, and that was with a stop to get food.
Okay, here's a quiz question.
I saw a half an inning.
Quiz question for you guys.
The bottom of the ninth.
That's all you needed.
Because that was a very eventful game. There's a lot to process from that one. But guess the average time of game for the postseason so far. For the divisional series.
4 hours.
The average time per
game. Average.
Now, we haven't had any 19-inning games.
No.
Or anything. So it's not skewed by, you know, one game that took 7 hours.
Okay, so you've got to go on the average. So I'm going to say, Chase, don't look anything up. 340 will be my final answer.
340.
What's yours?
I was actually going to say 345. So around that range.
It's exactly 345.
345. Wow.
Cool. That's too high.
Well, you
think?
You think that's
okay,
too high?
But it's what's different? College football is the same way. College football, especially in the postseason, way too long. But I don't understand why nobody does anything about it. They all say, oh, yeah, the game's kind of getting too long. Well, do something about it. You know, it just drives me crazy.
What? What are you going to do about it?
Well, number one, they shorten the breaks. No, you shorten the breaks between innings. That's 10, 12 minutes right there.
We've talked
about
a lot of this stuff.
There are things you
breaks,
can do.
Once you're in the box, that's it. No, you're not. No timeouts. You can't. You're in the box. You just keep pitching. There's no timeouts. Adjust your gloves. Take a practice swing. None of that stuff. We've talked about all that. I don't know what they can do. This is what I do know. You're not going to like this because this would add more time. They botched that the call. I mean, they botched it.
Which one?
The sixth. Well, you're right. Which one is a fair question? The Wieters passed ball. Okay, that was botched badly, and
it's not reviewable.
How can you not be reviewable? I mean, what do you have that in place for if you can't review that? That's the silliest thing. One, I don't know why you have limitations on reviewable plays. You have a rule in place that verbatim states exactly if this happens, and by the way, that's exactly what happened last night.
Oh, verbatim.
Word for word. Then this is what the call is. Well, the problem is none of the officiating crew, the umpires, saw it. So nobody could make the proper call. Why isn't it reviewable? You have a rule in place. It should be reviewable.
Well, let's for people that didn't see the game, let's quickly say what happened. There are runners on base, I think, at what?
First and second.
First and second. Two outs, two strikes, right?
Yes. Yes, because it should have been a strikeout.
Right. So it was a pitch.
Dead play, inning over.
Right. So the batter swings and misses at a pitch ball. The catcher drops the ball. Misplays the ball.
He just missed it. It went right under Wieters and all the way to the backstop.
Which is another thing we'll get to. But in the process of swinging and missing, the batter, as he comes back around, hits the catcher, Matt Wieters, in the mask. By rule, should be a dead ball, strike three, inning over.
Inning over.
But because Wieters misses the ball, it goes to the backstop. He throws the ball into right field. The circus starts, and the Nationals, again, continue to be the Nationals.
A lot of us self-inflicted.
Postseason buffoonery. They just cannot get out of their own way.
But in fairness, you're right. But that should have never happened. It should have never happened because the proper call was when his mask, there was contact with his mask from the bat, the play should have been ruled dead, and it was strike three.
Right. Now, I will say this. I'm not really sure why that rule is in there. The fact that Wieters got hit in the mask had nothing to do with him missing a ball. How does he let that ball go? It had nothing to do.
We don't know that, though.
The ball was well past him by the time the bat hit him.
Was it well past him?
It was past him.
Okay.
He missed it. Okay. Pedro Martinez said the same thing after.
Maybe it played into, though, his wild throw. I mean, you don't know how hard he got hit. You don't know. He was maybe out of disjointed. I don't know. I mean, he's... You don't know when that play happens, what's going through his mind. He was probably going, why haven't they said anything? Why haven't they stopped this? He's running. He tries to make a throw, and he's going, hey, he hit me in the mask. That's strike three. Play's dead. And so maybe he was worried about getting to the ump. It should have never happened, bottom line.
The weird thing is the umpires did the right thing. Matt Wiener said,
together.
You hit me?
They got
he hit
together.
Me in the mask. And he went out and asked. You got five other umps out there.
Said no. Didn't see
and
it.
Nobody saw it. What the heck?
You brought up Pedro Martinez. What do you think about that crew? Pedro and Gary
I love
Sheffield.
It.
No. No.
I love Pedro.
No, Pedro and Sheffield, Gary Sheffield is no. That's a no. Thumbs down.
I love Pedro Martinez. I'm not a big fan of Casey Stern.
I'm curious to think, why you're going this
I
way.
I think Pedro Martinez is extremely smart on how he sees the game. I love listening
Gary
to him.
Gary Sheffield, I don't think, brings anything to it.
He's all right. So you like the other crew better?
Yeah, I do. I do.
I just start laughing when I see David Ortiz and Keith Hernandez. They just make me laugh.
Right. But that's okay.
Yeah. Alex Rodriguez still bugs me.
He does bug me. I think he does a good job.
He's really good, though.
He's really good.
He's good. But here's what I don't like about him. He's first of all, he's A-Rod.
He cheated?
First of all, he's A-Rod. He's got all that.
I understand. Get past that, though.
He has this way of, like, slowing down and saying things like this way. When the ball game is going on. You know what I'm saying? He's got this annoying way. It's not natural. It's not the way he...
Wait a minute. A-Rod annoying? No one has ever said that.
But, like, he's got this trying too hard thing that...
Breaking news.
Why do you think...
It's the way he's saying
stuff. Why do you think he was the most disliked player in the clubhouse?
I know. But he deserves some credit. He's good. He sees the game well.
He does. Look, put everything else aside. He brings the most to the table when it comes to info and talking about the tough. Pedro, I mean, I can handle it.
Oh, I like Pedro.
I don't love him at all.
I like him a lot. Who's the other guy on the set besides Sheffield and Pedro?
I was going to ask that. I don't know.
I'm blanking. But I thought he was.
On the other side of the host. I don't know.
Casey Stern. Who is it?
Jimmy Rollins.
Jay Roll.
Is that Jimmy Rollins?
Jimmy Rollins, yeah. That's right.
He's good.
He's pretty good.
He's good.
He's got energy. I like it.
That's Jay Roll?
Yeah. Jay Roll.
Huh. Yeah, he's good.
That crew to me just seems, I can't decide if they're trying to be like inside the NBA laid back.
Of course, the whole poopy pants.
That was not good. That's a thumbs down.
Thumbs down.
But I thought their discussion of that play was good. I think that rule needs to be looked
at. You thought it was good? I didn't think it was good. I thought it could have been better. I thought they could have done a better job. That is a critical play. I thought our discussion was better than their discussion.
Well, of course, because we're great at discussing things.
But they're the ones that should be the ones wowing us with that discussion. I didn't think they wowed me.
All right, can I ask you guys another question? Because this plays into the whole issue of replay, right? The unintended consequence, and we've talked about it in all the other sports. The ball in basketball, the ball goes up. It's a rebound. You and I both go for it. Boop, it's out of bounds. We both hit it. Who's it off of? In the past, referee just makes a call. That's whose ball it is. End of discussion. Can't tell. How do you know?
Yeah.
Both teams are pointing in both directions, right? It's ours. Now, we slow the game down. The guy goes over and looks at the monitor. You can't tell on the monitor anyway. It's 50-50. Who knows? I mean, sometimes you can, but sometimes you can't.
But
we got by for 100 years.
I know, but
doing it that way.
But we also didn't have a lot of stuff.
Moved on. There's several of those annoying calls where you're like, you can't tell anyway.
Right,
so why are we here?
You can't say, hey, we got by for so long. We didn't have it in the past.
I know.
You can't go back.
You can't do that.
You can't go back. I understand. But this is the world we're in. Football. The completing the catch and the football move. And did his hand get under the ball? All of those things that happens a lot. It's annoying. Hockey. The same thing. Was a skate on the ice? Was it not on the ice? Is he, where is it? Is it conclusive? Was that over the line, out of the line? There's some calls that just drive you crazy on that. And now with baseball, the whole issue of the guy sliding into the base, he's back in time.
What was your opinion? Right call?
Well,
wrong call?
Technically, he's out.
Okay. Then it worked.
But I hate that.
It doesn't matter.
When you slide back.
It doesn't matter.
You can't.
You just said technically it's the right call. So how can you present another side?
And I do think there were some people saying it was inconclusive. I think when they showed both angles at the same time and you could see that Rizzo, mm-hmm. right, held the tag mm-hmm. the whole time where his foot came off the base for like a tenth of a second, then that was conclusive. So it was the right call. But I hate that.
They got it right, though.
I hate that, though. When you slide, there's no way you can control when you slide into a base feet first, which is the safest way to slide. and your foot hits the base, you're not magnetized to the base. Your foot is going to come off the base. I guarantee you, if they had replay, you go back through the postseason for the last 30 years, you'd probably change two calls a game.
And runners have been given the luxury for a very, very, very long time in baseball. There have been many guys who have never touched second base on a double play.
Right, and that's changing now.
But there were many, many guys that made a living off never touching the bag, and they were called out.
I just think it's physically hard sometimes when you're running as hard as you can, and this was a guy trying to get back to first. He should have dove back in, or he should have not been far enough off the base. That's too important a run to even be close for a catcher. So you can go back in standing up. But when you slide feet first, it is awfully hard to keep your foot and your body on the base the whole time. The rule was not designed for a tag play. If you beat the throw back and you get to the base back, you should be safe. You should be safe.
But if your foot comes up, then you say, but look, I mean.
I know. This is the unintended consequence. You love it if you're the Cubs. That bailed them out. Wade Davis was in trouble. He was. He did a great job of recovering. This is another good point that I thought Pedro Martinez made. It gave him a breather. It allowed him to reset, and he went back out there and was much better in the ninth inning. I'm thinking there's no way he's getting through the top of the order in the ninth inning. I thought he was running on fumes.
It'll be Dusty Baker's fault. It always is. Somehow everybody will blame everything that happened for 19 hours last night on Dusty Baker. It never fails. We'll come back. We'll head to Columbia, South Carolina. We'll talk about the Gamecocks. We'll do that next on 3D 102.5 The Game. What am I missing?
Chase has selected today's musical theme.
What is this? Is this a tie-in to our next guest?
No,
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. I was like, what am I missing here? Vols, Gamecocks, South Carolina.
I think it just hit Chase. It just hit him right in the face. He wanted some
Whitney Houston. What am I missing here?
Like women of the 80s and 90s.
Oh, okay.
Women of the 80s and
90s. That's the theme today.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that really narrows it down. 20 years of women singers. But who was it that really sparked you? Was it Whitney?
It was Whitney.
It was the late Whitney Houston.
That's fine. I just was like, what am I missing on talking about the Gamecocks and Whitney Houston?
I was listening to some radio yesterday, on my phone, actually, and Whitney came on, and I was like, okay, this could be good.
Why don't we just go all Whitney? We can go all Whitney.
Okay, let's go all Whitney.
We'll go all Whitney. We're okay.
Let's move on before people start saying, you know what, I can't take this any longer. Phil Kornblut, Sports Talk South Carolina. He talks about the Gamecocks all the time. Phil, how you doing? Good to talk to you again.
Doing great. How are you guys?
Well, just thank you for hanging on there, because I thought maybe you might bail with this introduction.
No. I like me some Whitney Houston, man.
So the Vols made news this week whenever it was put out there that they're going to go with the redshirt freshman coming off their bye week in Jarrett Garantano. Interesting game. And then they're in the same spot as they were last year. They were coming out of the bye week. They had lost two in a row, and, of course, they lost to South Carolina in Columbia. So here they are again, coming out of a bye week, losers of a drubbing at home, and they've got South Carolina again. But that was a heck of a win against Arkansas. That really got my attention. Not that they beat Arkansas, but in the fashion that they beat the Razorbacks.
Yeah, it was a Will Muschamp victory, the kind of win he likes to get, a dominating defense, a defense that created turnovers, and they got the benefit of scoring off the turnovers, got their running game going, and after a shaky start, Jake Bentley settled in, had a nice finish throwing the football. And, you know, they have not had many breathers in Muschamp's time at South Carolina. A lot of very close losses, and the wins have been narrow as well for the most part. So he could finally sort of take the headsets off in the fourth quarter and relax a little bit. So the feeling around South Carolina after that win is that they're on the uptick. They're getting better by the game. Players have balled in, and now they're starting to understand the things that Muschamp and his staff have been coaching them up on over the last year and a half.
You know how this works, Phil. You get to the midpoint of a college football season, and injuries start to mount. It's always inevitable every year. Usually the better teams survive. They don't have the big blows. Where is South Carolina right now on the injury front?
For a couple of weeks there, they were really shaky on the offensive line. Three starting offensive linemen were down, and they're still not back totally. Two will travel with the team with a chance to play. Zach Bailey, who would be the right tackle, and Corey Helms, who would be the right guard. Malik Young, another tackle, remains out. So they're getting a little bit healthier there. Of course, the big blow was a couple of weeks ago, Deebo Samuel going down with his injury. He remains out. They're hoping, crossing their fingers, they can get him back in the last couple of weeks of the season. Of course, he was off to a phenomenal start. I believe he had five touchdowns in the first couple of three games. So they miss him dearly. And then last week, one of their tight ends, a valuable player, Casey Crosby, went down with a similar injury, and he's done for the season. So those are the main ones for them. Defensively, they've been pretty fortunate that they're healthy, especially they're thin in the secondary. Their secondary's playing very well. They're thin back there, but they're healthy right now, and that's something that Muschamp is he's crossing his fingers about there as well, because if he can keep that starting group and the top five healthy and on the field in their secondary, he feels like he's got a good group.
I said at the beginning of this that Tennessee has made the decision to switch quarterbacks. I believe it was this time last year before this game when Will Muschamp decided to do the same thing, and this is when we had our first look at Jake Bentley. Where is Jake Bentley from back at the beginning when he first got the start, which I think was this spot right here, and the rest of his first season to where he's at in year two?
Well, actually, he made his first start in Game 7 for South Carolina last year. They opened 2-4. They had a bye week. Then they played UMass, and that's when he started. Tennessee came in the next week.
Okay, so he had Tennessee a start. Okay. All right, so that was his second game.
He had a start against UMass, and he had a very good game against Tennessee last year. He was the numbers weren't huge. He was 16 of 20 for about 200 yards and a touchdown. He was sacked six times, and I think what impressed people was how he kept getting knocked down by that very good Tennessee defense and getting right back up and without knowing the playbook. Now, you're talking about a guy last year who should have been in high school. And so in a two-week period when they decided to start him, they had to force-feed him the playbook. And, of course, he was limited the entire rest of that season with what he could do. They could not use the entire playbook. They couldn't audible because he didn't know it. So to answer your question, he's come a million miles from that. He knows the offense inside and out. He can change plays at the line of scrimmage. He can do the RPO stuff. So he's a much more complete quarterback. And he's having a good year, 60% passing, about 1,400 yards, protecting the football for the most part. They did work with him this week on some things technically. He's been overthrowing his passes, especially early in games, and he sighted happy feet for that. Something, you know, in the summer he worked a lot on movement in the pocket. He feels like it's led to some happy feet and not keeping his feet quiet. So they worked on that this week to see if that will remedy that situation and he can get off to a better start throwing.
We're talking to Phil Kornblut from Sports Talk South Carolina, breaking down the Gamecocks and the Vols coming up tomorrow. And Phil, Will Muschamp has really had a lot of success against Tennessee, and he also looks like he's taken a step forward in just how to run a program. Tell me what you see in terms of his maturity. He's still a pretty young guy. He's very fiery, which is one of the reasons he got to where he was. But I thought for a while he had to really work on keeping things in check. What do you think is – helped him improve and do such a good job at South Carolina?
Well, I think he realized that he was given a life rope by Ray Tanner in the coaching world. I mean, how many guys get fired in an SEC school and then are back as a head coach at an SEC school two seasons later, you know, sitting out 1 year as he was an assistant in Auburn for 1 year, and then the next year he gets the chance to come to South Carolina. So he still has that same fire. Now, maybe his demeanor on the sideline is a little bit calmer than what it was during his assistant days and maybe when he was down in Florida. But he still has that fire and that determination. And, you know, he is, I think doing things the right way. He's recruiting as hard as he can. They're giving him everything that they possibly can give him. I mean, South Carolina has some attributes to its program, and it's got some built-in negatives to the program that you have to overcome as a coaching staff. And so, they're trying to do the best that they can along those lines, knowing that when it comes to recruiting and attracting attention and attracting talent, they've got that monster 2 hours up the road called Clemson that's just riding high right now. So he's trying to build his program from the inside out via recruiting and getting the best players that he can and just sticking with his philosophies. And, if the Arkansas game is any indication, then they are making progress and starting to benefit from that. That's why I think tomorrow's game is certainly a swing game for both of these programs. You know, one is being viewed on the way up right now, that'd be the Gamecocks, and one is being viewed as on the way down right now, that'd be the Vols. As we all know in college football, it's a week-by-week perception. And if South Carolina goes in and wins tomorrow and beats Tennessee for the second year in a row, that could be it for Butch Jones, because we know what's coming up next week for the Vols. On the other hand, if Garantano goes out there and plays a great game and they're able to get Kelly going, running the football, and they pull off a nice win, that could change the entire perception of things. So, again, it's a week-by-week thing, but South Carolina feels like that they're moving in the right direction. And there were some people who were skeptical when Muschamp was hired, because it appeared Tom Herman was going to be the guy, and Muschamp was a fallback guy. But sometimes, the guy, it's not your first choice that turns out to be the best. It could be that second or third guy who comes in and gets it done. And, if Muschamp doesn't succeed at South Carolina, it won't be for a lack of trying and having all the resources necessary to win.
Phil, I've always felt every time I've been to a game at South Carolina, I just marvel at the following that they've had, considering that, in the tradition, they've got a very good tradition, but they don't have maybe a Texas or an Alabama or whatever you want to talk about at the top of the top, but they have a fan base that is like that. So I'm curious, you mentioned Clemson. Clemson's right now riding on a high note, on a high wave, and for a long time, not too long ago, South Carolina was beating Clemson every year. How do the fans manage expectations with all of that?
You mean the fans of South Carolina?
Yeah, basically, because they've had a run where they've done well against South Carolina. But as you said, Will Muschamp's only in his second year. So how patient will they be? How much time does he have to try to get back up to where they start beating Clemson again?
I would say that he's got a pretty lengthy rope here because Ray Tanner hired him, and he's going to give him every opportunity to build the program and become successful. I don't think there's any rush to judgment here as far as Tanner and the administration goes. Now, forget about the fans, okay? I mean, like I said, it's a week-to-week perception. If you win this week, they're going to love you. When they lost out at Texas A&M, they had a lead. They couldn't hold on in the fourth quarter. And, of course, everybody on Twitter and on social media, they were ready to run him out of town. He can't do this. If he can't win at Florida, what makes you think he can win at South Carolina? That kind of stuff. But I think the cooler heads over at South Carolina understand what he's going through and what he's trying to build. And so I think he's got plenty of time here to get it together and show what he can do. I mean, what's the shelf life of any coach who's trying to build a program? After about 3 years, people want to see progress. So, he came in a complete mess last year with what happened at the end of Spurrier's time, and he squeezed out 6 wins from that team, changing quarterbacks at midseason with a kid who should have been in high school and still got him to a bowl game and nearly won the bowl game. But people, of course, remember getting embarrassed by Clemson. In his time at South Carolina, he has never, only one game have they lost where they were completely annihilated and blown out, and that was the Clemson game last year.
You mean the team that won the national championship?
Exactly, yeah. And they were just completely overmatched with Clemson. And they may be overmatched with Clemson when they come to Columbia in November, but I don't think it'll be a 50-point game this time. And that's one thing that Muschamp took that loss very personally last year, and to this day, he has not let that loss leave his system. So he's driven by that, which is, you know, if you're South Carolina, that's a good thing. So, you know, I think Ray Tanner, having been a former coach, is going to be patient and give him his opportunity to build this thing the right way to put some foundation there where it's a long-lasting success. And I think Muschamp, I think he's at the point in his life and his career where if he builds it at South Carolina, he's not going to up and leave. I mean, he's appreciative of this opportunity. He can let his kids grow up here. He bought about a $3 million house out on the lake. He's got a great life out there. And he's a pretty popular fellow right now. So I don't think there's going to be any rush to judgment on the administration's part in terms of what he's doing. I think they see progress, and they're willing to give him the chance to build it.
Jeez, $3 million house. I should have got into coaching. I should have done that.
And I might be undervaluing that a little bit, too. That's just off the top of my head.
Hey, good stuff. Thanks for doing this, as always. We'll talk to you down the road.
Hey, anytime, guys. Have a great weekend. And we got Vandy coming to Columbia in a couple of weeks. So if you need anything on that, let me know.
I was going to say, we'll probably check back then. Phil Kornblut.
You got it.
Sports Talk South Carolina. Gamecocks and Vols. It'll be 11 o'clock kickoff. It's the early game, Central Time, in Knoxville. We will come back and wrap up the first hour of 3D. We'll do that next. Little Whitney theme today. Cameron Wolf, who covers the Titans for ESPN, he'll join us in the second hour. Listen to this stat that I was looking at. NHL Network just put up when we were in the break. Philip Forsberg, you know, had his fourth goal last night. It ended up being the game winner.
Right.
Do you know how many goals he had last year in October?
Well, he had three goals in the first 30 games of the season.
31. Yeah, it took game 31 for him to get his fourth goal.
Right.
Last October, how many goals did he have? The entire month.
I don't think he had any.
Is that your final guess? None?
I think none, because the season started a week or two later. And remember, we were talking about, well, he's got six assists or seven assists.
Right. He's getting the assists.
He's getting the assists. Remember, that was our theme.
Yeah. Well, it was true.
He didn't have any.
It was true. That is correct.
He didn't have any.
He had no goals in the month of October and finished with 33.
31, I think.
31.
Yeah.
That's right. 33 the year before. But he had no goals in the month of October last year. He has four. Here's the question. Is Forsberg now going to be in the discussion of a 40-goal scorer?
And I think there's also a bigger question that will work into that.
For Predators franchise history, that's a big deal.
Well, 33 is the record.
That's what I'm getting at. That's a huge – that's his uncharted territory. They've never had anybody with a 40-goal season.
I think he's capable of doing it, yes. And I think another question would be, are we going to continue to see more offense in the game? Will that sustain itself? Will there be more goals scored and therefore more 40-goal scores? I think the answer could be yes. Could be.
Well, I asked him. I got a chance to talk to him yesterday morning after skate, and I interviewed him for pregame. And I asked him the question, you know, the last two seasons you've had 30 or more goals, but it's really been the second half when you've just got on these heaters and you're just unstoppable. And not only are you the best player on the Predators roster, there are patches and stretches. You're the best player in the league. Now you're off to this really good start. Remember, I'm asking this when he has three goals. He had two goals in Tuesday night's win. I said, are you personally, you know, maybe changing your approach a little bit? Are you thinking about changing that up, trying to get, you know, get off to a better start in the goals department. And, of course, you know, I understand his answer. He's like, no, I'm always trying to get off to a good start, and I get that.
Yeah.
He's not trying to ease into the season, right, with goals. I get that. But it is interesting how the last two seasons they've looked the same, right? Early on in the season, October, November, even like mid-January, it's kind of pedestrian. It's like, huh, when's Philip going to get going, right? That seems like the same time.
The last 2 years,
when's Philip, right, when's Philip going to get going? And then, boom, when he gets going, then you never hear that again, and he's off to the races. So I understand his answer, but I was curious to see how he would answer it, and if he would say, you know what, I'm not trying to get off to a slow start, but I have, you know, looked at this in the offseason, or I did work on it. He didn't go down that path. He's just doing what he does best, and that's score goals and whatever his approach is, and take it game by game. It's just played out the last two seasons where it's looked light early on, and then there's an explosion.
The year that he burst on the scene, which was Peter Laviolette's first year, when this is another example of Peter Laviolette seeing a young player and saying, that guy has got some talent. I'm putting him in there. Remember, there was the year before Barry Trotz's final year, and this is nothing against Barry Trotz, but Barry Trotz, generally speaking, was much more calculated in you had to earn your way into the top spots. You had to start by playing a little less. You had to show that you could be responsible.
It's about trust.
You had to earn it. Yeah, and you had to do it over some time. It wasn't going to be the first night. Peter Laviolette, his first year, he saw Philip Forsberg in training camp, and he was like, that guy's going on the first line. It's pretty much – and we were like, whoa, is he ready? You know, maybe – I don't know. First line.
Because that was a different mentality. We've been used to one mentality here the entire life of the franchise. And here's this brand-new coach, and he's coming in and saying, here's this young guy that they made this big trade for. Remember, when they got him, he was, what, 19?
Yeah. And, you know, Philip Forsberg was earning it in training camp. It's not like he didn't do anything. Like, he dominated the rookie camp, and then he was great all through, kind of like Gerard was. And so they said, let's get him in there. And he did come – he did burst on the scene early in the season last that first year, his rookie year. So it's not like he's never come out of the gate strong, but the last 2 years, it's been weird. So it's definitely different this year. And sometimes there's a little bit of luck. Does the puck bounce your way? Does a guy make a great play for you?
I know, but then you wonder, well, how come the luck wasn't there in the same stretches, you know, the last two seasons and now? So,
I remember we had the discussion, and when I would go on with Braden and Fitz, they would say, well, what's going on with Forsberg? You know, where is it? I said, 300 hitters at the end of the year usually hit 300, even if during the season their average is at 260 or something like that. I said, just wait. He should break out of it, and he sure did. Now, who knows? He could come out like a house on fire and have 15 goals by the end of November. That doesn't mean he won't go through a patch where the production drops off. But see, this is where good teams that are built, that have depth, if one guy goes cold, another guy is getting hot at the same time. And by committee, you get enough production. That's where guys like Fiala and Aberg and Craig Smith are so important, to just get their goals, chip in their goals when the opportunity happens. Arvidsson got one last night. So, you look at the offense now, now it looks more like, hey, this is how they put the team together. Bonino looks so much stronger now. Hartnell's doing what they signed him to do. Hartnell made up being the best $1 million player in the league.
He's going to end up being
the biggest bargain going.
Yes. He already is. Four games in.
No doubt.
He already is. I'm just saying, you watch. If he has a big month of October, which he's already well on his way, you're going to start hearing people. Not just in this market, but when we start having Kevin Allens like today, or Greg Wyshynski, or these guys from the NHL Network, Mike Rupp, or our buddy Kevin Weeks, you watch. It's going to be, hey, Philip Forsberg, 40 goals. I see it. I think he's going to have 40 this year. You watch. That stuff will start happening. If he keeps this, he keeps doing this. He has a big month of October because it hasn't been that way in the past because he's had two 30-plus goal seasons, and now he's off to a different start. You watch. Early November, people will be like, hey, I'm telling you, I wouldn't be surprised if he gets 40. And then I'll look at you and go, I told you that about three weeks ago.
Yep.
To prepare for this. All right, we'll come back with Cameron Wolf. We'll talk about the Titans. Ironically, they do not play on Sunday. They are the Monday night game here against the Colts. Can they end this streak? What is the status of a lot of guys, including their quarterback, Marcus Mariota? We'll get into all that to kick off hour number two of 3D. That's next.